chacun.
So here we are in Daf Dalet Amud Beis, and we're beginning a new sugya today, Mirtz Hashem. But what I first want to do, as I promised you yesterday, is to go back to the Ramban on Bittul Chametz. This is the first Ramban in Masechta Pesachim. And just to review, the Ramban first presented Rashi Shita. And Rashi has this new concept called the Bittul B'Lev. Thank you. It's called Hashpasa B'Lev. And then he quotes a number of objections of Tosus. And Tosus says, Achilet means that the time for Tashbisu is at noon on Erev Pesach, which at that point is already after Shas Isuro, and we have a principle of Bittul that Bittul doesn't work after Shas Isur. Then another objection against Rashi was that Rabbi Akiva derives that Ach B'Yom HaRishon Tashbisu is referring not to the first day of Yontif, but rather to the 14th of Nisan. And he knows that because Havara is an Av Malacha. It couldn't be possible that we were commanded to burn the Chametz on the first day of Yontif. But obviously Rabbi Akiva assumes an equation between Tashbisu and Havara, which means that we actually physically have to destroy the Chametz. Not the way Rashi says it, Hashbasa B'Lev. Therefore Tosfos, in the name of, he quotes Rabbeinu Tam, we have it in the name of the Ri, he also quotes the Rabbeinu Atzarfat, and they all agree that Bittul equals Hefker. And here the Ramban really laces it in very heavy. He says, how could it be that nowhere in Shas do we see the word Hefker with regard to Bittul? And furthermore, he says that Hefker has certain requirements that don't apply to Bittul. For example, Hefker has to be b'fnei Shlosha. Hefker, according to one Shita, is not Chal until somebody else picks it up. In the case of Chametz, who's going to go ahead and pick up my Chametz? You know, nobody wants my Chametz, and then nobody's here to get my Chametz. And therefore, it doesn't square with Rabbi Yossi. And this led us to the paragraph on the top left of the first page of the Ramban, the Od Kosher, where he invokes the Shita Rabbi Yossi in the Darim, that Hefker is Kimatana. That just like if I give you a gift, the object doesn't leave my possession until it enters into your possession, so too in Hefker, if I declare something ownerless, it doesn't leave my possession until it enters into your possession. And therefore, it's impossible to accept the equation of Tosfos of Bittul equals Hefker, because in the case of Bittul, no one else is being Zoch in the Chametz. And the final line of this Ramban, I'll just read it to you, it's in the middle of the paragraph, the Ode, he says, Ulahach Svara, according to the logic of Rabbi Yossi, Hefker Chimtzo, if a person went ahead and made his Chametz Hefker, calls Manchelo Zochabo any Yehudi until a guy would acquire ownership on this Chametz of Hefker, is over, he should violate Balyaro Bayimotze. And we never found that after Bittul there's a requirement to make sure that some guy comes in and takes away your Chametz, he hauls off all your Chametz. Furthermore, the Ode, he says, Stam Hefker is b'fnei Shlosha. We never found that Bittul is b'fnei Shlosha. And his final question is that the Gemara seems to assume that Bittul is allowed on Shabbos, and yet according to Tosfos, if Bittul equals Hefker, then we should apply the Gzeira Mishum Mekach U'Memka. We're not allowed to do any monetary transactions on Shabbos. That's a Shavus D'Rabbanan of Shabbos. And therefore, Bittul should be prohibited on Shabbos insofar as it's Hefker. And that leads us to the paragraph, the Ode. And that's what we got up to yesterday. The Ode, Anim Estapek Be'inyan Azeh, Sharishonim kulam amru bebitul. He says, I have another issue in my mind that bothers my mind. The Rishonim have a formulation of bitul. Kol chamira de'ika b'shusi. Any chametz. This is important because this word is going to come up over and over again. In Aramaic, the translation of chametz is chamira. That's the first word on the second line. And any chametz that's in my rishus yehei batil v'chashuv ki afra, it should be considered like the dust of the earth. What's the source? Where did the Rishonim get this formulation from? He says b'gmar Yushalmi nami koloshen azeh pirshu. We also find this in the Yushalmi. Rav Amar tzarchi yomer kol chametz sheyesh li b'toch beisi v'eini yodea bo yivatel. So you want to underline those words, eni yodea bo, because that means he's not aware of the existence of the chametz. The implication is that bittul would not be effective if he's aware of the chametz. And then it says, v'eini yodea im adam mafkir b'loshen hazeh. The Ramban vacillates. He says, I have serious doubts as to whether or not this language, this formulation, which is not only quoted by the Rishonim, but it's also explicit in the Yushalmi, if that would be effective in Hefker. For example, a person would say, all my nechasim should be betelim. They should be null and void. V'chashuvim ka'afer. You know, the man owns a serious mansion in some sort of Italian neighborhood, where the mafia is. He's got this beautiful mansion, right? And he says, let this mansion be considered like the dust of the earth. Does that make it Hefker? Yeah, he's giving up ownership of a multi-billion dollar house. And then, once again, we don't find a correlation here between Tosus' definition of bittul, his equation between bittul and hefker on the one hand, and the formulation of bittul, the words of bittul on the other hand. The words of bittul don't in any way seem to reflect an equation between bittul and hefker. He says, v'efshar zeledivir eish lakish. He says, perhaps you could defend this formulation, this declaration, and make sense out of it according to Reish Lakish, because Omar Dehad Hamashma B'Maseth Dekrisus B'Makabel Matonish Yomer Li'acher Lacher Shebosa Maton Li'on B'Telehi. The Gemara has a possibility that if I give you a gift and you receive the gift, and then after you're holding on to the gift in your hand, I declare betelahi, it's null and void, then there is a possibility in that case, tibotel, that maybe that would completely void my ownership over this object, shekala machzik ba zochaba. Yeah, okay, so it could be that the Ramban wants to say, he had a double argument about the nusach of bittul. Number one, what is bittul is not hefker. And number two, ka'afra di'ara, like the dust of the earth, that's not hefker. If a man owns a mansion, as we said before, and he declares that it should be like the dust of the earth, that's not hefker. But he backtracks a little bit, wavers on the point about bittul, that maybe the language of bittul could be effective in monetary transactions, because he has a Reish Lakish and Maseth Dekrisus who says that if I declare about a matana that's already in the hands of the recipient, I make a declaration of betelahi, and then it could be that means that I completely null and void any ownership rights that I have, and that would be effective as hefker. But on the other hand, mikolmakom, the words chashuvim kehefker, the words in the declaration that I consider this like chashuvim ke'afar, excuse me, that I consider like the dust of the earth, just kiru hagaonim zal, lamam. How do you explain that? Hello, afro shaladam. Okay, now here you have to read the thing. Eino mufkar. Now, exactly what the value, the market value of afar is, I do not know. I assume that if you take afar and you mix water with it, you can create some sort of a concoction. So maybe afar is also important. For example, kisei adam, you need afar. So let's say I'm about to be mekayem the mitzvah of kisei adam and I don't have any afar. So it's worth something to me. So perhaps you could say that a person, when he says that this should be like afar, you might want to argue that's hefker. Says the Ramban, how could that be hefker? Because offer itself is subject to ownership. Do you follow? I mean, if you found some entity on the face of the globe that was absolutely ownerless, it was absolutely valueless, and no one would own it, then maybe if you declared that your chametz should be like that object, maybe that would be meaningful, and that would make it into hefker. But to declare that your ownership on an object makes it, because the object is like offer, that's not hefker. A person doesn't say that it's not that all offer is hefker. Not all offer is hefker. There's such a thing as ownership on offer. So to say that because I declared it's like offer, therefore ipso facto I made it into hefker, that's not so. So again, the barrage here against Rabbeinu Tam in this Ramban is because the nusach, the formulation of bittul, does not seem to reflect hefker, neither in the sense of batel. The word batel doesn't seem to indicate hefker. You know, if a person would say about his nechassim that batel, that doesn't mean he's mafker it. He doesn't relinquish his ownership. And number two, ki afra diara, that you're equating your chametz with the dust of the earth, is that hefker? Who says that the dust of the earth is hefker? You can own dust of the earth. Go into a store, buy a pound's worth of offer that you need for whatever purpose.
So how do you define, on this basis, how do you define bittul?
Well, that's what the Ramban is leading to. I don't know if we'll get to it today, Michael, but the punchline is in this very long presentation called the Efshar, and that's where the Ramban is going to come up with his own definition of bittul. Right now, the Ramban is in what I call a destructive mode. He's knocking down Rashi, he's knocking down Tosis. Rashi makes no sense, because Rashi equates bittul with hashbasa b'lev, and we see that bittul requires a declaration b'peh, it requires something verbal. Not only that, it seems that Rashi derives bittul from hashbasa, from the word tashbisu, and he has many proofs that the word tashbisu means to destroy the chametz and not to be mevatel the chametz. On the other hand, he presents Rabbeinu Tam's equation between bittul and hefker, and he throws that out of the window too. So right now he is in a destructive mode, if you follow me. Like he's playing bowling pin. You know, he's bowling. He's knocking down bowling pins. Now, if you knock down bowling pins, if you knock down on the right and you knock down on the left, you're still left with pins in the middle. So hopefully, the Ramban is going to come up with some modus operandi, some working definition of bittul. Then just to read another few lines in the Ramban, he says, V'od yeshli sofek behefker l'fisha tzrichu b'gemara trei kroy. I have another doubt. This is pretty way out, Rabosai. The Ramban at this point is saying that even if I grant you that bittul equals hefker, so what? Does it mean that if I say something is hefker, I therefore, ipso facto, I spare myself from Bal Yirah Bal Yimotzei? The Ramban is now raising an unbelievable possibility that again, this has tremendous repercussions in Masechta Pesachim. That it's quite possible that even after you mafkir your chametz, you still perhaps would violate Bal Yirah Bal Yimotzei. That's why. And we'll see in a second what led the Ramban to this conclusion. Now keep in mind, if we go back to Rabbeinu Tam, who identifies bittul as hefker, and he says that that would protect you from Bal Yirah Bal Yimotzei, as the Gemara says, with bittul bi'al masagi. So Rabbeinu Tam quoted a Gemara that says, shalchai atarua, aval atarua shalacherim. Do you remember that? That was in the paragraph Leficha, and we saw it in Tosus, Dibra Maschil Midoraisa. And this pasuk says lecha, right? Both in Bal Yirah and in Bal Yimotzei, the Torah uses the word lecha. And Chazal derived from this, the Gemara later on in Davav, that shalcha I atarua. If it's yours, you're not allowed to see it. Aval atarua, but you're allowed to see shalachirim. Says the Ramban, yeshli sofik behefker. I'm not sure that hefker really is achirim. Because really, who owns the hefker?
No one.
No one. So it's not really... Again, it's not lecha, but it's not shalacherim. It falls between the cracks.
But it is two different things. One is your chometz, which there's this whole argument about, and the other one is acherim's chometz, which you don't have to worry about.
So that's the question. What happened? Do I have to get to the point of acherim in order to obviate lecha, in order to protect myself from the violation of lecha? One way is to say, no, as long as it's not lecha, it's hefker, it doesn't belong to me, it doesn't belong to anybody, that's enough. And that's what you and I would have said. But if you're careful about it, when the Gemara says lecha yatoro, it doesn't say aval atoro shel hefker, it says aval atoro shel acherim. It sounds like, but again, if you hold on for another minute, you'll see where the Ramban builds his case on a different Gemara, not on that Gemara. But I'm just saying, if we focus on Rabbeinu Tam's Gemara, and Rabbeinu Tam says atorah shel acherim, and therefore bittul's hefke, you've protected yourself from bal yorbei matz because there's no violation of lecha. But yet, if we're careful about it, the Gemara says aval atorah shel acherim. I could see the chametz that belongs to you, and again the question is who you is, let's say a guy, I could see the guy's chametz in my possession, it's not mine, and I don't violate by Rabbi Matzah. What happens if I see the chametz that was mine, but it's no longer mine, but it doesn't belong to him, because I made it hefker? And you and I would have said, for sure there's no Bali Rabbi Matzah, that's a dover pashut, there's no doubt in anyone's mind, that's not lecha. You need a positive ownership on it. And the Ramban is now shaking us to our very bootstraps. He's questioning the very foundations of the whole sugya here. And he's saying that it could be that when you make your chametz hefker, you still are attached to the chametz. And it's not, it doesn't obviate the violation of Bal Yerovei Matzah.
Because it's not acherim.
Right. Now, where does the Ramban get this from? He gets it from a Gemara on Daf Hey, excuse me, on Daf Hey, and the Gemara needs two psukim to tell you that there's no Bal Yirah Bal Yimatzeh on chametz that belongs to a guy. Two psukim. Okay. Now, by way of introduction, there's something called Nachri Shekibashto. Okay, now the root of this word is Chaf Bet Shin, which means kibush. So back in the day, when the Jewish people would, let's say, enter into the land of Israel and they would conquer the land, they would subjugate the goyim, and some of these goyim they would take as kind of avodim, like slaves. Yeah, I'm using words that are not sharp. You know, that's not really what we're talking about. But in any event, there's something called a classical guy, a classical nachri, is called Shaloki Bashto, meaning he's just a free guy, you know, out there, John Paul Jones, and I have no relationship with him. Then is a guy that has a relationship with me. He actually lives in my premises. Okay, he's called a nachri Shaloki Bashto. He's not an Eved Kanani. He's not an Eved Kanani because he has not undergone any gerus whatsoever. He's a pure, full-fledged guy. You know, he's chayiv in seven mitzvahs b'neinoth, and that's it. But kibashto. Kibashto means he is under my control, my domination. He is subjugated. He works for me, and he lives in my possession, in my premises, and so forth and so on. So the Gemara says the following. If I only had one lecha, I would say that one lecha would exclude a classical nachri. That's called shalom kibashto. And the Gemara goes ahead and says, but I need another pasuk lecha for a nachri shekibashto. That maybe, if not for the second lecha, even though the chametz belongs to the guy, but because kibashto, because he's somehow under my tutelage, under my subjugation, I would still violate Bal Yirah Bal Yimatzeh. But what's common, Rabbos say, to both these cases, both of which are excluded from Bal Yerubay Motzei for two different psukim. If I only had one pasuk, I would have assumed that's only Nachri Shelo Kibashto. How would I know about Nachri Shekibashto? For that I would need another pasuk. But what's common about both these cases? Who owns the chametz? A guy. Says the Ramban, okay, you have two psukim to set up two categories of ownership of goyim, two different kinds of goyim. He says, "Ve'ilu hefker lo asu minayhu." But hefker doesn't come into the drasha. There's no drasha for hefker. Is he telling me that one lecha excludes this type of guy, he's low kibashto, another lecha excludes another type of guy, he's not misha kibashto, but in both cases you have the ownership of a guy over the chametz. So the bottom line is that even though this guy is working for you and maybe you support him and he lives in your premises, etc., etc., but nevertheless he owns the chametz and you don't violate Bal Yerubay Motzei. Why don't you violate Bal Yerubay Motzei? Because he owns the chametz. There's no indication, says the Ramban, that we have another pasuk for chametz that's not owned by the guy, but it's hefker. So again, as I told you before, this is a very revolutionary Ramban, because the Ramban is postulating, or at least presenting the possibility, I'm not saying he's signing on to this, that even if the chametz is not mine because I made it hefker, I still might be in violation of Bal Yerubay Motzei. And Rabosa, I'll give you an example, a contemporary example. And I've seen this over and over again. And the poskim are up in arms. They don't know what to do with this. People, after they finish the bedika, they still have tons of chametz in the house, in the kitchen. Is that not true? Yeah. You know, we do the bedika, okay, we have this little bag of chametz. It might be empty, or might have 10 pieces in it, whatever it has. And guess what? In the kitchen, I've got tons of food that's either left over or the last week or month, or maybe it's cereals that I didn't get rid of, and I got like bags full of stuff. So what do you do with that? Again, if you want to sell your chametz to a guy, that's one thing, but let's say I'm not selling my chametz to a guy for whatever reason, what do I do with it? Where do I throw it? We call it a tzfardea here in Israel, you know, those big green bins, right? So the poskim are not sure about that. They think that might come under the law of hefker, which means basically I'm saying if anybody wants to come and take my cereals, and I may have tons of stuff and some of it is very edible, come please and take kol dichvin yesev yecha. I'm inviting the whole world to come and take my chametz. That is hefker. So Adarabba, I would say great. If he was mafker it, it's no longer lecha. He doesn't own it, so he's obviated by Yerubay Motzei. But they're worried about this Ramban, that hefker might not be enough if no one else owns it to protect you from Bal Yerubay Motzei. Now again, I'm not going to give you the final word. You know, the post can come up with brilliant, brilliant ways of solving this problem. I'm just giving you the problem. And all the contemporary post can deal with this problem. Everybody and their uncle takes this massive amount of chametz and they dump it into the dumping bin. And basically that's hefker. And I'm not sure that hefker itself is enough to protect you from Bal Yerubay Motzei. And it's all based on this breakthrough Ramban, who says that hefker might still be subject to Bal Yerubay Motzei, which is another argument against Rabbeinu Tam. How can Rabbeinu Tam identify Bittel as hefker? V'ilu hefker, says the Ramban, lo osu minayi, we have no pasuk that excludes hefker. Says the Ramban, why don't we have a pasuk to exclude hefker? And why would we need a pasuk according to Rabbeinu Tam to exclude hefker? Says Ramban, they came under lesley bailim. On the one hand, paradoxically, you don't own it, but on the other hand, lav da acherim hu. What does that mean? Lav da acherim hu. No one else owns it. The afal pishena shalcha. And you might argue, well, it's not mine, and therefore, how could I possibly be in violation of Bal Yerubay, Bal Yemotzei lecha? It's not lecha. Says the Ramban, Eino Bechlal Heter Zeh. It's not included in this heter that's excluded from Lecha. Why? And here the Ramban drops the bomb. He says, the Iu Matzi Zachi Be Benafshe. Because it's right here in front of him. He just made it hefker. All he has to do is pick it up and re-establish his ownership over the chametz. And that's Tvemi Kibashto. That's even more accessible and more possible for him than Kibashto, than a guy who is under his tutelage. Because even though the guy is under his tutelage, he's kibashto, nevertheless you can't just grab away his possessions and say, well, I'm taking it away, I'm confiscating your possessions. See, that's where Michael is different than an Eved Kanani. Because Eved Kanani, I might be able to confiscate his possessions, but not in a Nochish and Kibashta.
So this is why we sell it, presumably, so that it doesn't have to be the law.
Correct. Once you sell it, you're okay. But the Rambam wants to know, what does it mean, bitul bi'alma sagi? The Gemara doesn't say, bitul bi'alma lo sagi, but sell your chametz. The Gemara says, bitul bi'alma sagi. The Torah relies completely on bitul, and that obviously circumvents the problem by Rabbi Matze. Why is that so? If you're going to tell me, like, I made it tam because I made it hefker, well, is it really true that hefker spares you and saves you from bayura bayimot? That's the radical nature of this Rabban. So if you want to underline the key words or highlight them, since you have a photocopy of it, you'll underline the words, ve'iu motzi zochi be'benafshe tfei utfei miki bashto. That it's very easy for him. It really hasn't left his dominion yet, in a certain sense. You know, here's something that I own. And you remember, I always tell you about the game we used to play as a kid called Snatch the Bag, right? So here's something I own, and then I drop it. Snatch the bag. Well, I'm going to snatch it. Because I just put it down here. It's very accessible to me. I can immediately acquire ownership on it. And if it's so accessible, then I really haven't gotten it out of my rishus. At what point is it certainly not lecha in any shape or form, and I have no way of acquiring ownership of it?
When somebody else owns it.
Once somebody else owns it, the door is locked, the door is closed, that's gzela, I can't take it away from it. But as long as it's efker, then I'm allowed to take it away. Now, if you'll fast forward, this is for tomorrow, but I just want to show you where we're up to for tomorrow. About seven lines in this paragraph, he has Elokach ani Omer. I tried to underline. I don't know if it came out in your photocopy. Do you have that Elokach ani Omer? Somebody should have pressed the return button when they printed the Ramban. In other words, this is a new paragraph. At this point, with Elokach ani Omer, I'm going to leave you in suspension till tomorrow. Here's where the Ramban defines bittul, and it's a brand new definition of how bittul operates. In the section that we skipped, he quotes the Yerushalmi, and the Yerushalmi says, "Lo yirolecha istnai tonu lo yirolecha shalchaya taroa avla taroa beflatya, but istnai ditno afil beflatya." Now, flatya is what's called hefker. Flatya—that's not the literal translation of the word flatya, but flatya means a public square. So that now I put my chametz in a public square. Now what happens the moment you put your chametz in the public square? It's hefker, it's right? So the Yerushalmi quotes two tanoim. Machlokas tanoim. We're going back to the time of the Mishnah. One tana says, avolatoroa beflatya, meaning you're allowed to see your chametz if it's in a flatya. Why are you allowed to see your chametz in a flatya? Because you made it hefker. But is tanoi, there are other tanoim who say that afilu beflatya is still violated by yirah bayimotze. That means there is a violation of yirah bayimotze according to that school of thought, even in the case of chametz shel hefker. And therefore, it doesn't make sense to identify bittul as hefker. Number one, because none of the sugyas seem to indicate that bittul is hefker. Bittul is bittul, it's not hefker. Nowhere in Shas does it say hefker with regard to chametz. Nowhere. And the answer is because hefker itself would not be enough. Even if I would grant you somehow that the word bittul, like he has a sugya of Reish Lakish increases, that maybe the word bittul could be appropriate for relinquishing ownership. But nevertheless, we nowhere found that relinquishing ownership on chametz is definitely a solution to the problem of Balei Rabbi Matzi. You're still liable for Balei Rabbi Matzi, even after Hefker, according to at least one opinion in the Yerushalmi. And according to the Bavli, we have two psukim to allow you to have the guy take over your chametz, whether it's a regular guy or a chiddush, even if he's kibashto. But nowhere does it say that you're allowed to make your chametz hefker and therefore obviate balyura bayimot. So all the sugyas seem to indicate that hefker is not, that bittul is not hefker, and it's impossible therefore to assume, like Rabbeinu Tam, that when it says bittul ba'masagile, it means hefker. That doesn't make any rishus. It's got to leave your rishus and enter into the rishus of someone else, even if it's a nakri shekibashto, but I'll call upon him, nevertheless, he owns the chametz. Until he owns the chametz, you are responsible for the chametz. Because you haven't taken the chametz out of your possession, even though you made it hefker, because you can easily reacquire ownership over the hefker. Therefore, elakach ani omer, for tomorrow, mirtzah Hashem b'li neder, we'll have to get back to the Ramban and see how the Ramban manages to explain bit. And now, Rabosai, we're going to start the Gemara on the bottom half of Daf Dalet Amud Beis. And we're starting with the two dots. The first word of the line, about 10 lines up from the bottom, is Bimamone. Bimamone. Now, at this point, the Gemara is going to analyze a Mishnah on Daf Yud Aleph Amud Beis. If you want to quickly, without losing the place on Daf Dalet Amud Beis, take a look at Yud Aleph Amud Beis. You'll see a Mishnah that records a machlokas between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. Now, this machlokas between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda addresses the issue of what's called Sha'os Dirabonon. Let me write that down. This is our subject. Okay. Now, what this means is that on a Doraisa level, Chuta Torah or Chametz becomes prohibited at the end of the sixth hour, the beginning of the seventh hour, which is on a perfect day, 12 noon. Okay, that's Chametz Shel Torah, Doraisa. 12 noon, we'll call it. Okay, 12 p.m. The Rabbanan made what's called a Harchaka, right? This is a classical Harchaka, to push it up. Meaning, they're not going to allow you to rely on the sundial. You know, that's how they took, you know, they took time to see where the shade comes from the sun, if you put up a pole or something, and figure out when exactly is Chatzos, which is the Doraisa time, right? When Chametz has to be out of your Rishus, Chatzos. And by the way, how do we derive this Halach of Chatzos? Again, Rabbo, so let's get the lingo. That's called Ach-Chilek. Ach-Chilek. Right, in the Torah it says, Ach-Bayom HaRishon Tashbisu, Ach-Chilek. Ach divides the day into two equal parts. And now there's Machlok Shin Rabbi Yudin Rabbi Meir on Shos Derabbanan. Is it enough if I tell you to get rid of your chametz 1 hour earlier, and that 1 hour buffer zone is sufficient, or do we need a 2 hour buffer zone? So that's what the Mishnah records here. The Remeir Omer, Remeir says that you can continue eating your chametz the entire fifth hour, which would mean from 10 to 11, and at 11 o'clock, which is 1 hour before Chatzos, that's called Tchila Sheish, Sarfin. At that point, we burn our chametz. So according to Rabbi Meir, we burn our chametz on a perfect day at 11 a.m. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, no. That sarfin bitchila. I'm sorry, I made a mistake here. Just 1 second. Al chamesh. Sarfin bitchila shesh. Yeah, I'm sorry. The the shita of Rabbi Yehuda is that we have to stop eating chametz on the fourth hour. At the end of the fourth hour, meaning the beginning of the fifth hour. So he's going to add another hour. So Yehuda's going to require that already at 10 a.m., is that what I said? I meant to say it. At 10 a.m., 2 hours earlier, we have to stop eating chametz. So let's go back to Daf Dalet Amud Beis. And the Gemara says the following. Okay, now, let me add another element into this equation. There's something called Trumas Chametz. Right? What's Trumas Chametz? Right, we know that all five species of grains require Hafroshas Truma. Okay? And then he took the truma. When I say he, it doesn't matter who took the truma. And he converted it into flour. And then he added water. And it became chametz. That's called trumas chametz. Now, in the case of truma, we're in a kind of a sensitive bond, and it's like a tug of war. You know, we're being pulled in two different directions. One direction says, "Well, it's chametz. Get rid of it. You know, it's almost chatzos. You know, it's a few minutes before noon, and the Torah says you're not allowed to own this chametz. Get rid of it." The other side says, "Don't get rid of chametz if it's truma, because we're not allowed to destroy truma. Truma has to be eaten by the Kohen." So in order to reconcile these two polar extremes, we're going to try to delay the burning of chametz, in the case of truma, to the last possible moment. I call it damage control, meaning to minimize the damage of what's called hefsei truma, that we don't want to destroy truma. So I say this by introduction so that you shouldn't get confused here by this Mishnah, which is now being quoted. Tnan Hasam. So we learned in a Mishnah, and the Mishnah says the following, that Rabbi Meir says, how long of a harchaka in order to begin to, you know, to add extra time and separate yourself from chametz? How long of a time? Ochlin kol chamesh. So you're allowed to continue eating the chametz until the end of the fifth hour, and then sarfim b'tchila sheish, at the beginning of the sixth hour, which, as I said before, is 11 a.m., 1 hour earlier, before chatzos, you should get rid of your chametz. And there's no chashash, there's no worry, we don't have to suspect that maybe he'll make a mistake of more than 1 hour. So according to Rabbi Meir, what's the maximum margin of error? 1 hour. Clear? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, no. Ochlin kol arba, we're allowed to eat during the fourth hour, which would mean from 9 a.m. till 10 a.m. Now I'm going to skip for a minute to sarfim b'tchilas sheish. So in other words, even though we stop eating chametz at 10 a.m., we're only going to burn the chametz at 11 a.m., the beginning of the sixth hour. What goes on in that middle hour? On the one hand, we're not allowed to eat chametz in that middle hour from 10 to 11, according to Rabbi Yehuda, because there's a mistake, there's a margin of error here of up to 2 hours, according to Rabbi Yehuda. And the Gemara is going to go into great detail on Daf Yud Aleph to see why is it that, you know, you can't tell the sun and this and that, and then you could, there's a cloudy day, and you might make a mistake of up to 2 hours. Oh, so then the question is, if you have to stop eating the chametz at the end of the fourth hour, which means at the beginning of the fifth hour, you're already enjoined from chametz. That's the fifth and the sixth hour is a 2 hour harchaka in which you're not allowed to eat chametz. So why don't we require you to destroy the chametz already at the beginning of the fifth hour at 11 o'clock, like Rabbi Meir? Start again. According to Rabbi Yehuda, why don't we get rid of the chametz at the beginning of the fifth hour, already at 10 o'clock, right? Why are we leaving the chametz in limbo for 1 hour?
Really, you can do it.
It seems that if there's a truma issue, then we don't want to get rid of the chametz. Then we're going to allow an extra hour in the case of truma so that we're not mafsid the truma. And so let's desperately try to get a kohen, you know, to eat a meal and eat up this truma during this hour.
Is he allowed to?
And he would be allowed to. In other words, what we're going to allow for the sake of hefsei truma is we're going to allow. See, I'm using the word allow, but it's a little bit of a mistaken term here. Not that we're going to allow, but that in this case we never made the harchaka. In other words, for the sake of avoid hefsei truma, we're going to insist that even Rabbi Yehuda would agree that we're going to postpone this harchaka until the beginning of the sixth hour. Again, all this is futuristic. Let's get back to more of the simple stuff. Let's ask the following question. Chametz, in the constellation of Macholos Asuros, of forbidden food, has a very special place because it's called Isurei Hanoah. So, for example, am I allowed to take chametz and feed it to my animal? And what's the answer? No. Chametz, in that sense, fits into a very well-carved, group that has very few members to it. Basar b'chalav is also b'hanoah, klai hakerem is also b'hanoah. There aren't too many cases of macholos asuros where the Torah says not only aren't you allowed to eat it, but you can't even feed it to your dog. Now, when we get to Shos d'Rabbanan, if you remember, I may have erased it, but oh, here it is. Shos d'Rabbanan, the harchaka that the Rabbanan made. Did the Rabbanan make that harchaka as far as achila, but not as far as hanah, or even as far as hanah? In other words, up to what hour am I allowed to feed my animal chametz? So here Rabbi Yehuda says that even though there's a possibility of making a mistake of 2 hours, and we're going to enjoin you from eating chametz already at the end of the fourth hour, beginning of the fifth hour, which means at 10 a.m., 2 hours earlier. Nevertheless, says Rabbi Yehuda, I'm not going to go all the way and say that you can't even feed your dog. Because if you feed your dog, although you do violate, if it were a doraisa, again, we're talking about our chokka d'rabbanan, if it would be after 12 noon, you would violate an isur of feeding chametz to your dog, but it's a lesser isur, it's a lesser violation than eating it yourself. So for example, if you eat chametz chas v'shalom on Pesach, you get kares for that. That's a very severe violation. But if you feed it to your dog, I'm not sure what you'll get for that. You'll be ostracized, whatever. You'll get a very strong musa shmuz, but you're not gonna get any serious punishment. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says the following: that when the Rabbanan made this harchaka and they were nervous about a mistake of 2 hours, and therefore they told you you're not allowed to eat chametz already from the end of the fourth, which means at already at 10 o'clock, 2 hours earlier, don't eat chametz. They didn't go one step further and say that we're gonna recognize that 2 hour margin of error even as far as feeding your dog. So as far as feeding your dog is concerned, which is called a hanah, we're gonna allow you an extra hour. What do I mean by an extra hour? Meaning within the framework of the Shos d'Rabbanan, which according to Rabbi Yehuda is a 2 hour frame, we're gonna alleviate the Isur hanah of chametz by 1 hour. So at what point in time, at what point on the clock, on a perfect day, would Rabbi Yehuda say you have to cease feeding your dog chametz? Exactly, at 11 o'clock.
And is that the real reason for the extra hour? That's the justification? Not feeding?
Well, when you say the extra hour, you mean
dropping the extra hour? No, increase from 11 to 10. And I notice I'm concerned that...
Going backwards is for your eating. We're worried about you might eat it at what you think is 10 o'clock when really it's 12 noon.
Ah, because that's what you're worried
so
about.
So if, let's say, you ate it at 9:59,
okay,
then we have no problem. Because even if you made a 2 hour mistake...
Why wouldn't the same...
But since feeding your animal is a lower Isur, it's not a violation of an Isur Kares.
Right.
So the Rabbanan felt that they didn't have to go so far and give you, again in Rabbi Yehuda's frame of reference, a 2 hour margin of error as far as feeding your dog is concerned. Because even in the worst tragic catastrophe situation, if you made a mistake, you would not be violating such a severe Isur. Sure. And that far they didn't go. So what they did was they allowed you 1 hour out of the two to feed your dog. Give me just 1 second and we'll read it inside because I just want to read the text. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ochlin kol arba, vitolin kol chametz. During the hour let me get the hour straight again, is Ochlin Kol Arba, right? So you could eat it from 9 to 10. Kol Arba means from 9 to 10. Again, I'm hoping this is helpful by translating into our numbers. The truth is that maybe I'm confusing us. Maybe I'm not sure if I did the right thing over here. Anyway, Ochlin Kol Arba, and then you get to the beginning of the fifth hour. The beginning of the fifth hour already, which is again 10 a.m. on a perfect light. You're not allowed to eat the chametz. So you would say, well, burn it. No. Says Rav Yehuda, you don't burn it. Why don't you burn it? Tolin Kol Chamesh. It's sort of like in limbo. Tolin means it's in limbo. Tlia means up in the air. What does that mean? Wait a second. What does it mean, Tolin? Tolin means that during that hour, from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock, you do not eat the chametz, but you don't destroy the chametz. Why don't you destroy the chametz? The answer is because you're feeding it to your dog. You're allowed to feed it to your dog. Yeah, now Don, the
okay. Yeah. So twice you used the same example and I got confused. 12 o'clock is when you're supposed to burn it.
According to the Torah law.
Oh, 11 is when you're supposed to burn it.
Wait, are you Shas the Rabbanu or your Doraisa? So let's start with the Doraisa. So let's go step by step.
Manish, so the Doraisa is 12. So
according to Rabbi Meir, the Rabbanu said 11. They gave you a 1 hour of margin of error.
So that's why the 1 hour goes back to 10.
No, why does it go back to 10? That's because of Rabbi Yehuda's sheet. Rabbi Yehuda says you can make a mistake of 2 hours.
So in terms of feeding your dog and the Rabbi Yehuda, which is the extra hour,
he's only worried about a mistake of 1 hour.
So the Jew has to stop eating at 10, but he can feed his dog to 11. Correct. And he burns by 12.
Well, I wouldn't say, no, he burns at 11. In other words, because at 11 o'clock, it's completely awesome.
Okay.
So whereas in Reb Meir's frame of reference, I understood intuitively why I'm going to burn it at the beginning of the 11th hour, meaning beginning of the 6th hour, which is 11 a.m., because that's when chametz became awesome. Before that, it wasn't awesome. At that point, you get rid of it. But according to Reb Yehuda, you should have already gotten rid of it an hour earlier, as early as 10 o'clock. The answer is because of this halach of tolin. What is this halach of tolin? For that 1 hour. So if you take a look at Rashi says Tolin. Can everybody find that Rashi? It's in the wider lines, about line 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Line 6.
We're on
Dalet Amud Bet. We've been on Dalet Amud Bet for quite a while, so things haven't changed much. I'm sorry. It's just that these are the basics. You know, we'll move faster later on, but now we're setting up the basics. So line 6, you see a Rashi that starts with the word Tolin. When I say line 6, I mean in the wide lines of Rashi. Rashi says, Tolin, what's the nature of that 1 hour between 10 and 11, according to Rabbi Yehuda? Lo ochlin v'lo sarfin. We're not allowed to eat it, because already from 10 o'clock we can't eat it. But we're not going to burn it. Why? Klomar ain't sarach lisrof. As Michael said before, if he wants to burn it, tovo lo bracha, fine. But there's no need to burn it urgently at 10 a.m. You know, when the clock says 10, you don't have to burn your chametz. Why? Because machil hu lebehemto kol chamesh. Because during that entire hour, which is from the beginning of the fifth hour till the end of the fifth hour, meaning from 11 till 11:59, he's allowed to feed his animal. So there's no need to force him to burn the chametz. But during that hour, it told him it's suspended. Me, he can't touch it, but he can feed it to his dog. Mitch?
That's from 10 to 10:59.
So Tolin would be from 10 to 10:59. What did I say? Whatever I said, forget about what I said. Right? From 10 to 10:59. Right? So again, at what moment, when what did the clock strike when you have to get rid of it?
11.
That's true both according to Rabbi Meir and according to Rabbi Yehuda, but for two different reasons. According to Rabbi Meir, the reason why when the clock strikes 11 you get rid of your chametz is because that's exactly when chametz becomes aser. Aser meaning bein bachila, bein bachilas kelev. According to Rabbi Yehuda, on the other hand, it's a little more complicated. Why are you burning your chametz at 11? Why not burn your chametz at 10 when you are enjoined already the 2 hour margin from 10 o'clock? And the answer is because you're allowed to feed it to your dog. And that's what Rashi calls tolin. The Gemara later on in Daf Yud Alef is going to say that tolin also has a tremendous bearing on what's called trumas chametz, because in case of trumas chametz, we want to delay the destruction of the chametz. Let's just finish it up and then I'll take questions, because you know it's getting a little late and I want to see if we can get to the end of the daf. He says the following. Oh. The kuli alma miha. Let's just try to get to the lowest common denominator that's universally accepted. And that is chametz mishei shos ulamala osler. we've already, you know, I let the cat out of the bag and I told you that chametz on a Doraisa level is also at noon. Minoah, how do we know such a thing? Let's go back to basics. Show me where it says in the Torah that chametz is prohibited on Erev Pesach. The Torah says, Shivas Yomin, and for 7 days you're not allowed to have chametz, you're not allowed to eat chametz, you're not allowed to possess chametz, lo yiral cha shivas yomin. But why add an extra half a day, tag on the Erev Yontuv? Me no. So Rashi points out here, Dekuli Amamiya chametz b'shei shol sulamala osim in HaTorah. Everyone agrees that at the end of the 6th hour, chametz is osim in HaTorah. De'ilo mitzarad urta, because if you would assume that chametz only becomes also urta, urta means at night, which is the kickoff of the 7 days of Chag, lo avi gozru be'rabbanan, they would have never had our chokah here, because everyone sees the difference between day and night. Let's say, for argument's sake, and again you could talk about Shkia, but let's talk about Seisa Kochavim. Seisa Kochavim is an astronomical phenomenon that's obvious to everyone, so there's no need for a margin of error. And not only that, the margin of error here that we're talking about is in the middle of the day, or even earlier in the morning of the day, right? So, why? It must be that chametz is also in the middle of the day. Well, Vushdeit, you know, we're Minolan. How do we know such a thing? And the Gemara is now going to go through an entire series of Yalfuses, of different suggestions as to how we know. You know, it was never a question. The Mishnah itself assumed as a universally accepted premise that chametz became also an Erev Pesach before Urta, way before nighttime. But how do we know such a thing? And the Gemara is going to offer different possibilities as to how we know such a thing. Now, just to let the cat out of the bag a little bit, if you fast forward for a moment without losing the place to Daf Hayom and Aleph, because this is really where we have to get to eventually at the end of the day, you'll count down from the top of the page about 12 lines or something. The first word of the line is Bayom, and towards the end of the line it says Ach Chilek. You see those two words? So you may want to underline those two words, because that's really, you know, that's the light at the end of this long, long tunnel. We're going to go through a long tunnel with all sorts of different possibilities. For those who learned Daf Yomi, I think you'll agree with me that, like, I don't know what percentage, but it's probably anywhere between 40 and 80% of what you learn in Daf Yomi is about derivations and how do you derive conclusions. I know we learned Zvachim here, Daf Yomi, and it was unbelievable how much time we learn Kiddushin, for example, like 90% of the Masechta is all that derivations. Sometimes you go crazy from it. So we're going to have here a classical sugi of derivations to try to prove that chametz is also not only on Pesach, but even on Erev Pesach. But the final light at the end of the tunnel is going to be called Ach Chilek. That the Torah is Chilek. Chilek means dividing. And when we say dividing, we mean miktas and miktas, meaning part and part. There's part of the day that is mutter and part of the day that's asur. And if we take the day as a 12-hour period, then we split it in half. We have the 6 hours of morning and the 6 hours afternoon, meaning afternoon till evening. And Rashi here, it's unbelievable, he quotes some very, very sophisticated gematria to prove that Ach in gematria equals Chetz. Chetz is an arrow. And an arrow splits something in half. Like William, what was his name? The guy who shot William Tell? What was his name?
William Tell,
yeah. If he was Jewish, his name would have been Teller, probably. But anyway, William Tell. And he shot the arrow and he split the apple right in half, let's say. You know, it was a perfect split. So the word Chetz means chetzio and chetzio. It's fascinating that the shorish of the word chetzi is chetz, which means an arrow. So an arrow means half. Half, okay, say it like the British if we can. And that's what it means, that we take the day of Erev Yontu, the 14th, and we divide it into two halves. Okay then? So that's the ultimate, that's the goal that we have to get to.
Just a quick question. At what point do you have the Isser of Bal Yerah Bal Matzah?
Rashi says something amazing, and everybody pounces on Rashi. Rashi says, here it's on Daf Dalet Amud Aleph, and you might want to underline this. I think you were away when we did this. Rashi says, okay, now let me see if I can help you find the Rashi. on the right side before the lines get wide, before they get wide, right? Rashi. In Rashi, you know, there's the skinny lines and then the L on the bottom, right? On Daf Dalet Amud Aleph. So before it gets skinny, the bottom Rashi says, V'ar Haner, you see that?
Yes.
Then you go up to the Rashi, V'nivdok Mitzafra, yes. And then you go up to the Rashi, Bein L'Rabbi Meir, Bein L'Rabbi Yehuda.
Yeah.
And Rashi says that whether you go like Rabbi Yehuda or like Rabbi the Iflugu, they have a controversy, B'masnisin in the Mishnah later on in Daf Yud Aleph, B'harchaka, how far of a harchaka, the Ovid Rabbanan le'oraisa, to the Torah law, was it 1 hour or 2 hours? And then Rashi says, Chomitz eino osu min haTorah bebal yiroe u'machila el mishay shos kiriolof mi achilik, etc., etc. Do you see what Rashi adds here? Two important words, bal yiroe. In other words, Rashi holds that from midday on the 14th, the Torah imposes on you the lav, the violation of a lav bal yiroe if you own the Chomitz. A lot of Rishonim ask how Rashi knew such a thing. The Gemara says you have to destroy your chametz at that point. Maybe the Torah is telling you, you know, 6 hours before Bal Yiroh, I already want you to be chametz free. But nowhere does the Torah say that on Erev Pesach you violate Bal Yiroh. Adarabba, the Pasuk in Bal Yiroh says Shivas Yomim, it says 7 days, which means from nighttime. But this is Rashi's view. So you have to underline those two words, Bal Yiroh and Rashi. And we're going to come back to Bali Netter again, but Rashi Shita is that you violate Bal Yiroh with Achilik, with Chatzos on Erev Pesach. So you can begin to imagine why the Rabbanan are so nervous about this. You know, in the days where the, you know, there was only astronomy to figure out what time of the day it was, and the Torah is saying midday. How do you know when it's midday? Did you ever think about it, Rabbi Osai? We take it for granted. We look at a clock or whatever you have, digital, whatever you have, and it says 12 noon. I mean, if you didn't have that clock, how would you know it's 12 noon? So you have to put in a, you have to put a stick in the ground and see when the stick has no shadow to it. You know that the sun is at its zenith. Obviously, there's a margin of error over here. You know, the Gemara in Pesachim speaks about the Kotel of the Beis HaMikdash, that if you wanted to know when it's time for the Tamid Shel Bein Arbayim, which is the second Tamid of the day that's brought in the afternoon, you have to see when there's no shadow from the Kotel, meaning the sun, and as soon as you see the shadow, I guess on the, if I'm not mistaken, on the eastern side, right, at that point you know you passed noon. And the Gemara says you have to give a half hour of before you bring the Tamid. So anyway, back in the day, they didn't know. So imagine, according to Rashi, you know, it's one thing to say without Rashi that at 12 noon, if you didn't destroy your chametz, you're in violation of an essay, meaning you're negligent in fulfilling an essay. You know, like the Torah says that you have to do a mitzvah on a certain day and you're delaying it. That's bad enough. But according to Rashi, it's much worse. Because if you have chametz in your possession after achilek, after chatzos hayom, you're in violation of two lavim, of bal yiroh and bal yimotzeh. Now I see we're running low on time, so I'm going to just ask you the following question. We have a principle in halacha, two principles. Let's start with the basics. The first basic principle is that if you violate a lav, and all the conditions were met to establish that you violated the law, the mazid, deliberately, what's the punishment for that?
Curse.
What's it called?
Curse.
For a regular law, for a classical law. Malchus. Right. That is a whole Masechta and Shas dedicated to that. It's called Masechta Malchus. Rule number two is that a law she'ein bo maisa, a law which you violate passively and not actively, in other words, the Torah is telling you don't remain passive, and you violated that law by remaining passive, ein lokin alav. You don't get Malchus for that. So we divide up the lavim into two categories. There's a lav sheyesh bo maisa, and there's a lav she'ein bo maisa. Where would you classify bal yiroh bal yimotzeh? Is the lav sheyesh bo maisa? Is the Torah saying don't do X? Or is the Torah saying don't be absent of X? Meaning don't leave the status quo. And it's a shevi altas. It's a passive lav. Passive, correct? The Rambam says that you get malchus for bal yiroh bal yimotzeh. When? And the Rambam has two examples. So one, if you buy chametz on Pesach. And number two, if you're machametz and is on Pesach. Which means that you roll the dough with water and you make it into chametz. And the Rambam holds that in those two cases, you transform the lav into a lav sheyesh bo ma'aseh. In other words, the Rambam is not saying that since in 99 out of 100 cases you violate by Rabbi Motzei by doing nothing, therefore the lav itself doesn't have the power in and of itself to generate malchus. No, the lav does generate malchus. There's nothing inferior or different about this lav. It's just that you don't violate the lav of the mice. But lu yitzur, if you can come up with a hechatimsa, says the Rambam, that you can violate by Rabbi Motzei with a ma'aseh, then you would get malchus for it. And it's really fascinating, because what would the Rambam say if a person took a shvua and he says that I will eat this kikar within the next 24 hours? And how does he violate that shvua? By not eating it. That's already a lav shein bo ma'aseh. So what would be, according to the Rambam, if he took the kikar and he burnt it? He threw it into the ocean. Would that mean that he's chayev malchus for it, because now he violated a lav shein bo ma'aseh, but with a ma'aseh? Is the Rambam saying that any lav shein bo ma'aseh, if you just technically find a way of violating the lav with an action, then you get malchus?
Why burning it? He's not eating it. Still not eating it.
No, if he's not eating it, that's a lav shein bo ma'aseh, right? He violated it passively. But what if he does something to make it impossible for him to eat it by destroying it?
Yeah.
Does that make it into a lav shein bo ma'aseh? Just like in chametz, your ownership over the chametz is passive, but you did something to own the chametz.
But the sure is that I won't eat it, right?
Right, and by Rabbi Motzei, the lav is that I won't own it. So ownership itself is passive. But I set up the ownership through a ma'aseh. And yet the Rambam says he involved. A very fascinating Rambam. Okay, Rabbi Motzei, so we'll stop here. And we said tomorrow we're going to be learning a lot about derivation, so that's what we have on the agenda until we finally get to Achile. And B'li Neder will try to present the Ramban's unique sheet in what bittul is. Okay, then? All right. Anybody have any sort of glue here? My Gemara is getting real beaten up. Okay. What?